This episode is brought to you by Mountain Sea Media. I spent half my life near the Pacific Ocean and the other half in the mountains of Central Oregon. These places are full of profound stories and experiences that guide my life, even now as a media creator and a beer professional. This is how Mountain Sea Media was born. I realized how impactful stories are to our lives and business. Stories share good experiences and the warmth of friends. They improve business by sharing these experiences and connecting deeply with our customers. If you'd like to connect better with your customers through copywriting and storytelling, contact me at jeremy@mountainseamedia.com. It's your story. I'll help you tell it. Welcome to episode 19 of Good Beer Matters.
You know, there's always those, wow, we can make a grass is greener type beer. No, good enough is not good enough. You know? And we're reinventing. I mean, the kind of the battle cry of Crux has been the next great beer.
I'd like to introduce you to brewmaster Larry Sador, who has been captain of the brew kettle since the early 1970s.
It's simply to have fun. I mean, I'm a brewer. I love to brew beer. That's what I do.
During his time, he witnessed American beer culture hit its lowest point.
Nothing's made me sicker in my whole career than to watch the light beer phenomena occur.
And even endured having to brew to the palates of the time.
I had a sales fellow one time tell me, Larry, the closer to water you can make beer, the more I can sell.
In the 1980s, he bore witness to the rise of microbrews. He was a believer amongst a sea of doubt as to whether micro beer would survive.
And they said, it's never going to become a thing. You know, those hippies with ponytails wearing flip-flops can only make so much beer in their kitchen.
Microbrews eventually became craft, and again he witnessed the now threatened national breweries' response to it.
The large breweries resisted it. In fact, I think some of the strategies were to make knockoffs of craft beer and kind of figure out how to kill it.
In the years that followed, Sador developed procedures and equipment that have improved the entire industry. He's brewed many world-class beers that have brought him medals and renown. In what may be his swan song, he has fulfilled a personal dream of opening his own brewery, Crux Fermentation Project, so he can continue pushing the boundaries of beer culture. My name is Jeremy. I'm a certified Cicerone, BJCP judge, IBD certified brewer, and a beer writer. I believe the art, the science, and the culture of beer has more of a profound effect on us than we realize. I believe there's a world of wisdom found in every glass, and I intend to get to the bottom of it. This is Good Beer Matters. These are the stories of us, of great food and the beer that brings it all together. I hope you enjoy episode 19 of Good Beer Matters with brewmaster Larry Sador.
Well, I'm sitting in this inner private sanctum with the godfather of beer from Central Oregon. He chuckles when I say that. I think when I mentioned that to you, you didn't realize that people refer to you as the godfather.
No, hadn't heard that.
And that might have been something I made up, but every time I've used that, people go, like, oh, yeah. I want to introduce my next guest. This is Larry Sador. He has a very long history in beer, particularly in recently in Central Oregon. And I call him the godfather of Central Oregon beer because you have probably spent the most time that I'm aware of teaching and guiding brewers who have then gone off in different directions and opened up other breweries in Central Oregon. And so if you were the tree, there are a ton of really good apples that are that have planted roots nearby. And so let me introduce you to the godfather, Larry Sador.
Well, thank you. That's quite embarrassing.
well, good. That's also part of the goal is to try and have some fun. You have a tremendous history in beer, and doing some research. I mean, there are plenty of stories and articles about you out there. So I don't want to rehash those. I don't want to tell the same stories that you've told 100 times because I'm sure you've told those 100 times. Those are easy to find. So the quick version is you got a degree in fermentation science. You thought you were going to be a winemaker, and you made a quick stop at Olympia Brewery and stayed a while.
Stayed 23 years.
So let's talk about. I'm going to do this in sections. Let's talk about the past. This was what year was this?
1973.
So a couple years from then California would enter in a very great way the wine world in the famous wine competition between France and California. And here you were a young winemaker to be who got into the beer world. Yeah. How did that happen?
Just purely by accident and not taking my business classes.
I was a toddler when this wine competition happened, but I would imagine that just the utter romance of becoming a winemaker and going out to California and being the next great winemaker would have been such a romantic, overwhelming notion. How did you resist?
Boy, I took a trip down to California, interviewed with probably a dozen different wineries, and at that time they were very immature. I mean, it was kind of like the craft brewing industry was in the early 80s.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
It just a few people. And really, honestly, the only way I figured I could get ahead was either go to work for Gallo, which Modesto wasn't my destination in life, and or marrying the winemaker's daughter. You know, one of the two. And so I really wanted to come back to Oregon and start, like, I think it would have been the third or the fourth winery in the state of Oregon.
Which, wine in Oregon back then, I mean...
Nothing.
Yeah.
It was three. I think there were three folks. I used to go pick up grapes at a few of the wineries and bring them back to Oregon State, and they would ferment with them. And the objective was to find yeast that was appropriate for the amount of acid that was in the Oregon grapes.
And so just a quick aside question, are you still a lover of wine?
Oh, yeah, I love wine.
And do you still have dreams of making wine and having a field of grapes? And
no, I left when I left Olympia. I went to work for the SS Steiner Hop Company.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of my deal when I moved to Yakima is I bought a 10-acre vineyard that mm-hmm. was mature, and so I sold most of the grapes commercially, but I held a few hundred gallons back and would make my own wine. So I fell in love with growing wine at the time, not in making the wine. And that sounds, I think, probably pretty odd, but I found the biggest challenge in winemaking was actually growing the grapes.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, and granted, I don't want to fall into the trap of beer versus wine at all, but isn't that where wine gets all of its flavor and nuances just out there in the vineyard anyway?
Absolutely.
As opposed to at the hand of the brewer and the maltster and the...
Yeah. I think the biggest job of the winemaker is blending. I think they're really blending masters, you know, to take the correct barrels and timing of the aging and such to perfect the final product.
Well, you know, that's an interesting comment you make, because I remember, single varietals, which are blends in and of themselves anyway, a Cabernet Sauvignon, there's always like no more than 10% of something else in there, if I remember. But I remember just like the blends were always just the red table wines, the cheap wines, the whatever. But to me, it seems that if you get a blend, this is the winemaker's interpretation of what tastes great and what he wants you to taste, or she wants you to taste. And that was an interesting notion, that blends were belittled.
Oh, correct. I think one of the things that I'm kind of getting to more is that you might have barrels, you know, 1 through 10 of a Cabernet, and you want to blend them with barrels 33, 34, 35, that type of thing. This is what fits together. I run into that quite a bit when we're blending different beers that have been barrel aged together. And, you know, you just have some that just are absolutely outstanding and they will fit in a blend, and others that, well, maybe there's another use for them.
Yeah, like
vinegar.
Yeah, vinegar. Yeah, yeah, for salad dressing.
Correct.
And so I would imagine, like you just alluded to, that you do the same thing, but with beer.
Yeah.
And so tell me about your barrel series. What do you call that?
We call it our banish series because what we do is we take the barrels and we end up banishing them to a couple locations within our brewery. One is we have a cellar that's warm, and we'll do a fermentation in there or a re-fermentation. Mm-hmm. And then we have another cellar that's cold where we're just looking to transfer the flavors that were previously in the barrel into the beer. So say it's a bourbon barrel or it's a Syrah barrel or something where we want to transfer those flavors versus another fermentation.
And so this is where the art of the brewer just continues on down the line, not only choosing the ingredients and having good relationship with the maltsters and all those purveyors of ingredients, but I mean just every step of the process. But now with blending, now you guys are tasting a little bit from each barrel and intentionally putting this together because this is how you want your art expressed, correct? Correct.
Absolutely. And so, we'll take barrels that if you entered them into a beer judging competition would be judged as defective. You know, they might have a little too much diacetyl, or they might have too much acetic, mm-hmm. or some other thing. But when you put them together in the right combination, it's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's where I almost want to create a new category. We can't really call it craft beer anymore. It's got to be art beer, because to me, craft implies you created something and now you're going to reproduce it with the best of your ability. And art is, this is brand new, baby.
Yeah, that's true. Well, exciting.
I know. Yeah. So we're going to start the new art beer movement. So we talked about wine. We talked about your barrels, but you made a very long waylaid stop in Olympia. Tell us about that.
Oh, that was the greatest place in the world. It was a job where I just couldn't wait to get to work every day. I mean, get up, go to work. You know, it was really a privilege. It was great people, great mentoring. One thing that drove me a little crazy was they, you know, they didn't make a move without studying it 10 times.
Right.
And, you know, they made very small little changes all the time. And, you know, they gave me opportunities. They let me move around the brewery in charge of all sorts of different departments. And it really set me up for a lifelong career.
And so if you're doing different things, then you learned every aspect of the brewing biz just about, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially after 23 years.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't let me into sales and marketing and accounting. And,
oh, yeah. You don't want to be a sales guy.
No. I'm not a sales guy. So, so it was just a fantastic opportunity, and it was great people, and it was just a shame it ended up going away.
Yeah. So that's part of the rabbit hole I want to chase down is help us understand the environment of beer in the 70s and 80s that you were there. I wasn't of drinking age, but my memory of beer back in those days and my study of beer back in those days is you know, not impressive.
So let me paint a little picture there is that, you know, early 70s, home brewing was illegal. You mm-hmm. you couldn't get the ingredients. You could maybe malt your own barley, go to some hop fields or grow some hops at home. You know, not a lot of that. There were, and what I'm about to say is very significant, is there were three television stations. And if you think about it, at that time, all the breweries were trying to go national. Mm-hmm. And so Olympia, which was a regional brewery, you know, we could advertise in, you know, 20 states, and it cost us $3 a barrel, where a national brewery that was already established could be all 50 states, and they could advertise for $1 a barrel.
Mm.
Big competition difference.
Yeah.
And, you know, light beer hadn't been, well, I mean, light beer was just about invented. And then Miller bought the company that invented light beer.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became the whole taste great, less filling thing. And nothing's made me sicker in my whole career than to watch the light beer phenomena occur. I had a sales fellow one time tell me, Larry, the closer to water you can make beer, the more I can sell.
Wow. And I remember those days as a kid. I should have realized my predilection for beer back in those days, because I always paid attention to that stuff. And I still remember seeing on the shelf, this is probably the lowest point of beer in our history as a nation or culture of beer. I remember looking up and there was that white can with a little blue stripe and it said beer. Do you remember those?
I made that beer. Olympia was later acquired by the company.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
Yeah, no, that was a sad day. And I mean, you know, if you think about it, when I first joined Olympia, it was a 120-day process. All whole hop cones were used, probably a 60-65% malt bill. Acidification took place in the brew house naturally, and by the time I left, we were doing everything that all the other brewers in the United States were doing, and we were putting beer out in 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it was really sad, but at the end of the day, you had to compete, you had to stay in business. We had a payroll of about 800-1,000 people, and you just can't say, well, this is the way I'm going to make beer, and I'm not going to sell very much of it, and sorry, you don't have a job anymore.
But in all fairness, we can't look back at those days and say, well, man, bell bottoms, what were they thinking? I mean, that was a sign of the times, but I mean, we almost have to go back further. I mean, from Prohibition, they finally allowed alcohol to be made again, and all the small brewers were just gone. All the big brewers, they survived. And as kind of amends, correct me if I've got my facts wrong, but to be political, they allowed 3.2% beer to come back in, so it was really light. And that kind of set the stage. And then the 50s and 60s, everything was mechanized and pasteurized and industrialized. And that was just, you know, the TV dinners were a thing. And the more we could make, everything was man-made. And that was, send a man to space and life was good. And so our beer reflected our culture in those days. Is that fair?
That's true. The only thing you're really missing there is after Prohibition, what really sold beer was... beer was the drink of moderation. Mm. That was the battle cry, and that's where mm-hmm. the 3.2 came from. It wasn't, you couldn't produce higher, but you know.
And that was okay for all you temperance people. Okay, we're going to concede, but not too far. We want to be respectful. We want to be political and diplomatic.
Right.
But we need to get out of this depression, so we're going to start brewing again. And
right
yeah. Fair enough. So this was the climate that that where we entered a young Larry entering Olympia in the 70s. Was there any discussion of what Fritz Maytag was doing down in San Francisco during these days?
Oh, Fritz was a good friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, Fritz used to come up to Olympia, and I'd walk him through the brewery and kind of show him what I was doing and various things. So, yeah, no, it was big. I mean, I tried unsuccessfully to hire a couple, they're rock stars now, but mm-hmm. young brewers to kind of give them a cellar, a kind of a obscure and obsolete cellar we had, but perfectly functional, had its own yeast room, had tanks that were kind of too small for Olympia. There were open fermenters in it. It was a wonderful, you know, well-maintained, well-kept cellar, but just didn't meet our, as you said, bigger, better, faster American concept at the time. And I sold the board of directors on, let's hire one of these two people, and they can brew anything they want in the brew house. We'll get whatever materials they want. Send this wort to the cellar and let them ferment whatever yeast mm-hmm. cultures they want. Let them go at it. And then from there, we had direct lines to the bottling lines, so then we could bottle it. And I got within about a week of offering a job to one of these individuals when I finally got the stops put on me.
Oh, no.
But it would have been real interesting to see what would have happened of this.
Those could have been the roots of the microbrew
yes.
movement, which turned into the craft brewer movement.
Yep, absolutely.
Oh, gosh. Sorry, I have to just think about that for a second. What a interesting near miss that was.
Oh, it was. It was absolutely.
So what kind of conversations did you have with Fritz Maytag then? I mean, he's brewing his steam beer and you're brewing the lager. Well,
Fritz is a very inquisitive person, and you know, he wasn't putting people in the box at the time, saying, "Well, you're a big light American lager brewer." Mm-hmm. No, there's something to it. You guys know something that we don't know, and can you help us, type thing.
Gotcha.
Because, you know, Fritz, when he purchased Anchor's team, I don't think he had a lot of experience. And in the 70s and the early 80s, there really wasn't a lot of experience out there. And so where were you going to go to learn and find out about those?
You just look it up on the internet, right?
Yeah.
Called the encyclopedia back then?
Yeah, pretty much. And that was one of the things. I mean, when I went to brewing school, I had to have the owner of the company and the brewmaster of the company sign a document that I was worthy to go to the Siebel's Institute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how it was a closed kind of Germanic type organization at the time.
Was it just like a tight fraternity that you had to know the secret handshake to get into the world of brewing?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. So so this was the climate surrounding the beer in America at that time. And we talked about, for some reason, I've got these crazy dates in my head. I want to say it was 1982, the Bud Light finally came out, or somewhere around the early 80s. Of course, you know, Miller Lite was doing its thing, but I mean, everything just got light, Coors Light, everything else was light. Thank God we got away from the generic beer. What happened? What happened in the 80s when the micro brews started coming out? And I my memories are going back to like Pizza Wicked Ale and other imports, but how did that transition occur between the macros and the micros?
Wow. What a question.
You got 2 minutes to answer.
I don't even know where to start. I have no idea. I'll go back to 1974. I remember going to my local distributor and ordering a case of Pilsner Uriquell. Mm. And, you know, I brought it. It took a month to get. And then once it came in, I remember drinking it and went, wow, this has got some really interesting, attributes to it. And some of them we would probably consider defective and so on and so forth. But overall, the total experience was a fantastic beer. And I remember taking them into work and tasting it in the taste panel. And the other brewmasters just kind of went like, Larry, this has a redeeming factor to it. And I went, well, yeah, you have to kind of overlook some of these attributes, but yes, it does. And I remember somebody saying, and I suppose you like some of that craft beer that's out there. And I went, well, yeah, some of it's really, really good. And we should be paying attention to that. And they said, it's never going to become a thing. You know, those hippies with ponytails wearing flip-flops can only make so much beer in their kitchen. And I just broke out laughing. And I said, you know, I'm going to remember that statement. And I think that, you know, there's only so much light beer we can drink. And so the question for you is, I think that the large breweries resisted it. In fact, I think some of the strategies were to make knockoffs of craft beer and kind of figure out how to kill it. Mm-hmm. I think that was the real plan. And so they really haven't embraced it. And I think the latest one, it took the purchase of Anheuser-Busch by the bankers to really buy into the concept of craft as a business.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. I remember recently watching a commercial. It was something to the effect of, I think it was a Budweiser commercial, something to the effect of this beer's not made by wussies or something like that, which I thought was just extremely ironic because here they are getting into the craft beer world as well, or whatever it is. And then and a couple Super Bowls ago, they had this commercial. It was just laughable. Everyone criticized it. You know the one I'm talking about? This is not your watermelon pumpkin, blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
But meanwhile, they were making a watermelon pumpkin, blah, 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 blah. And it was such a, oh my gosh, whoever's doing the marketing needs to be fired. And then they came up with Dilly Dilly. So here we are.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the problem with large companies in craft beer.
Yeah.
You know, there's a real disconnect between the different ends of the company.
It was just, it was mildly, I don't want to say offensive, that's a little too strong, but it was just highly suspect that here you are trying to hold out your left hand and your right hand at the same time, but you're trying to deny that the other hand is out. It was just, you know, just call it what it is. Just call it what it is. So interesting. So Olympia, you had a near miss with the beginnings of the craft beer, if I'm going to call it that much. Where did it go from there? What happened with Olympia toward the end of your tenure there?
So Olympia had an issue. The issue was they had too much money, and that was the time of takeovers where, you know, people could come in and buy a company for pennies on the dollar because their stock was cheap. But
so this low early 90s?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, no, it was Irwin Jacobs was the person who was trying to do the takeover. And I think that was 83, something like that.
Oh,
so
way off.
Yeah, so we merged. Olympia merged with Pabst. Pabst, you know, all of us were friendly.
Okay, I
used to spend time at Pabst. I used to spend a lot of time at the Coors Brewery in Golden. And in fact, I just heard Bill Coors died here just, I think it was yesterday or the day before. So that's a shame. He was a real gentleman. But anyway, Blitz Weinhardt, I used to spend time with, Rainier, I mean, and, you know, whole group. And so we merged with Pabst, and that turned out to be pretty much a failure. I don't think Olympia realized it, but Pabst wasn't doing so good at the time. And so it wasn't a real wise choice. And then we were purchased by a company called S&P, which was a holding company, and they owned Falstaff, they owned Narragansett, they owned Lucky Lager, General Brewing, Brew 102, on and on and on. So anyway, I think I went from brewing one or two beers to about 20 or 30 overnight.
Well, and I think when you and I met in passing just a week or two ago, I think you mentioned that one day you're brewing Olympia, the next day you're brewing Pabst beer, the next day you're brewing something else.
Yes.
Is that about the sum of it?
Absolutely. And then it got so crazy. I mean, this is the thing that's wrong with big businesses. We ended up brewing one beer. It was called Hop. Hams Olympia Pabst.
Gotcha.
You know, one brand, one stream. And because simply we couldn't do it. I mean, we had, you know, multiple yeast rooms and all that type of thing, but it was just at the end of the day, you know, it wasn't cost effective to do that. And so that's the problem with these large companies buying craft is they're just going to end up saving money at some point. And so what is brand A or brand B will merge into brand AB, you know?
So will you talk about the beginnings of the microbrew movement? What did you see while you were still brewing the hop beers? At what point did you see these ponytailed hippies brewing some dark beer in their kitchens? At what point did you see that they were actually gaining some traction and might just be onto something?
Oh, I think it was early 80s. I mean, Bert Grant of Yakima Malting Brewery was a very close friend of mine. And you know, Bert was starting his brewery in Yakima. And he didn't have the wherewithal to have, you know, the laboratory equipment and personnel that we had at Olympia. So he'd make frequent trips over to Olympia, and I'd run everything through the laboratory. And then the brewmasters would get together, and we'd taste his beer and comment on it and such. So it was the early 80s that we really saw traction. You know, Red Hook with Charlie McKelvey and the whole gang up in Seattle we were close friends with. And in fact, actually, Charlie, I sold quite a bit of equipment to and, you know, kind of helped Red Hook get on their feet. You know, so it was, you know, I think in the Northwest, we probably played the most friendly with the craft brewers of anybody in the United States. I did a project in, I think it was 1981, where I converted some hop jacks we had that had whole hops, but it had lauter tub plates to it. And those lauter tub plates I sold to the Widmers, I sold to Full Sail, sold to Bridgeport, on and on and on. You can go anywhere in the Northwest, and I bet you can find a vessel in a brewery that came from Olympia.
So you were in beer sales.
Oh yeah. Well, it's pretty funny. I was walking down the street at one of the OBF events, and I was with Gary Fish and Rob Widmer, and Rob said, "Do you remember when?" And I go, like, this is shortly after I announced I was starting Crux. And I go, "No, Rob, I don't remember. What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, I remember we walked through the Boneyard Olympia one time, and you were showing me equipment. And it was like, yeah, this is for sale. Or this is, you know, I'm going to keep this one." And the question was, "Well, what are you going to do with it, Larry?" I said, "Well, I'm going to start my own brewery someday." And anyway, I'd forgotten totally about that. So, you know, I sold him a lot of equipment. And my wife is quite happy that we started Crux, because all that equipment that I bought from Olympia now is sitting around us.
You finally got it out of the garage?
Yeah, out of the house. I think I'd driven my wife crazy dragging all this stuff around for years and years and years.
How funny. So your tenure at Olympia came to an end, and then you alluded to this, that you decided to grow wine or grow grapes and make wine and sell hops, which is an interesting dichotomy right there. This sounds like there's a story there.
Yeah, no, so I'm an Oregon boy, born and raised in Oregon, and I've never had any plans to move out of the Northwest, and refused a lot of really great job offers over my career to leave the Northwest. And when I quit S&P company and under duress, I basically told my boss I quit and so on and so forth. Walked home and told my wife, I quit today. And I was working probably 80 to 100 hours a week at that time. And I had one cell phone and two beepers. I carried all and just constantly working. And she looked at me. We just finished building a wonderful house on Puget Sound together. And she looked at me and says, great. And I said, well, yeah, great, honey, but what are we going to do now? She says, I don't know. We'll figure it out. And anyway, so I think the next week I interviewed with the Haas company over in Yakima and with the SS Steiner company, and ended up taking the Steiner job. So I was operations manager there at the at Steiner. And then once I sold my house in Olympia, we bought a established house with a vineyard.
So I would imagine, especially how long had you been, you'd been at Olympia for 23 years.
Correct.
And so you, again, it's that little secret fraternity, secret handshake group. So I would imagine you knew all the maltsters, all the hop purveyors. I would imagine that finding a worthwhile employee in that similar line of work or extensions of was probably not that difficult for you.
Well, it was a challenge, to tell you the truth, because at the time I was making quite a great wage at the time, and I had two young children, and I wanted to live a lifestyle that we had become accustomed to. And one of the problems was that quite honestly, craft brewing wasn't paying very well. And so going into craft industry was a little challenging. I'd interviewed at Red Hook, and I was willing to take a pretty substantial decrease in salary, but I wanted something in return, and they weren't willing to give that up. So,
and what year was this, or what era was this?
Well,
about?
that was probably that whole interesting story is that when Pabst, we merged with Pabst, they came at us with, well, you need to reapply for your job. And I thought, well, that's kind of a funny kind of situation. And I knew a fellow up at Red Hook and said, do you have any openings? And anyway, so I went up for an interview for that. So that was a little earlier than that. But
did you play the whole, well, Red Hook is going to hire me, would you still want me?
No, I didn't at all. I ended up actually getting together with a couple sales and marketing guys from Olympia and that were actually let go, and we were talking about starting a chain of brew pubs, and we were acquiring some property in Pasadena and San Diego and Sun Valley. And I wasn't married at the time, and I thought that would be a great lifestyle. And so anyway, so it didn't pan out for some reasons. So I'd explored the starting a brewery several times, and just never really worked out.
The timing wasn't right.
Yep, timing wasn't right.
Fair enough. What significant impact did living on this vineyard and selling hops, what impact did that have on your later trajectory?
The biggest thing is I learned the hop industry inside and out. I mean, I just know a lot about hops. And I was reading an article in the Beer Growler just this morning and kind of chuckling, is that Bert Grant and I were talking in, it would have been 1998. And we were talking about how to extend the fresh hop season, because both of us love what fresh hops do to beer.
Yeah.
And I said, well, we should freeze them with nitrogen, Bert. And Bert goes to me, nah, nitrogen is the wrong material, Larry. CO2, we got to use CO2. So anyway, so we tried a whole bunch of cryogenic activities to preserve the life of the fresh hop, and we succeeded somewhat. But later on, I used that knowledge to do some cryogenics with hops to separate out the lupulin, and then take that lupulin out and put it in the beer. And that's what I've, you've ever heard of a beer called Red Chair?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I developed Red Chair.
Oh, so that's the secret sauce behind, you know, the world's best beer at that time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And that was great. So, you know, I learned those. I learned processing. I worked a lot with the Anheuser-Busch folks to perfect and optimize pelletization of hops.
Mm.
When I got to Yakima in 97, I was appalled at what they were doing with the hops. I would be driving to work and I'd be smelling these burnt hops and going, stop it, folks. We have to, you know, this is going to go into beer. This is important that we make higher quality beer.
Well, what were they doing?
Well, you know, I mean, when you pelletize hops, you're doing things that are really, really bad for the hops, but yet you're doing things that are really, really great for the hops. Meaning, you know, the lupulin gland, which is the essence of the hop, you're taking that, you're smashing it, you're exposing it to extreme pressure,
mm-hmm.
and if you do it wrong, you are generating excess heat. But then the good thing you're doing is you're cooling it down really quick, you're putting it in a impervious foil pouch, impervious to oxygen foil pouch, which preserves the shelf life. And so what I did is I actually took a playbook from Bert Grant, because Bert Grant at one time worked for the Steiner Company, and he had been exploring using CO2 to cool down the pelleting process. And so what I did is I worked with and got support with Anheuser-Busch to lower the pelleting temperature of the hops, and it worked out really well. In fact, so well that at the time Augie Bush flew up in his jet to Yakima to see what we were doing, and when he saw what we were doing, you know, he bought into it and awarded Steiner a fantastic contract.
Oh, fantastic.
To pelletize with. So,
well, and I got to be careful. There's so many tangents I can go on, but this one I think is compelling. But I am aware, as a professional brewer and as a brewery owner and a long tenure and legacy in the brewing world, that you have been quite the, what would you call it, the engineer and the spending a lot of time improving processes and equipment. And this is just from the comments I've had, and I think I actually got to brew on your system with a class one day, and you talked about how, yeah, I made this thing and it helps us do this. And can you talk about some of these developments that you personally have had your hands on to help the rest of the brewing world, if not your own brewery?
Oh, wow. I would say...
Again, you got 2 minutes.
I don't know where to start with this one. I would say one of the bigger things that I've done is refine the hop processing.
Yeah.
That's been, I think, as a total contribution to the industry, I think that's been pretty huge. The hops that were made in, you know, or processed in the early 90s or late 90s or nothing compared to what they are today. And every facility has benefited, whether it be, the Haas facility or the YCH or, Hop Union. I helped design the Crosby system, and I'm sure Indy Hop pulled a lot of it. So it's been a pretty gratifying. Other processes, I mean, you know, some of the processes I've used, I mean, I won't say I stole them. I just have used them. I mean, like the we have a sourwort program that I put in at Deschutes that really came from a Distelhauser brewery in Germany that I saw and I witnessed, and the Distelhauser people helped me replicate in at Deschutes, and I use it here at Crux and you know, those type of things.
But have you always been a tinkerer, or were you just had the ability to just take different knowledge from different aspects and apply it?
Well, let me tell you about Dr. Jack. Dr. Jack was a psychologist that Olympia Brewing hired. And you would go spend a couple hours with him every quarter and kind of talk about, you know, how your relationship with people were at the brewery and what you could do better and, you know, what you should stop doing and whatever. And I took one of these psychological tests where, you know, what are you type thing. And, anyway, I was having a beer with Dr. Jack, and he looked at me and he says, "I got the results from your test, Larry, and they're quite alarming." And I said, "Say what?" And he's just like, "Are you ever happy?" And I go, "Well, yeah, I'm happy all the time." And he says, "Well, I've never met somebody who is unhappy as you." And I said, "Well, what's the program with that?" And he goes, "You're always making things better. You're never happy with where you are with a process or whatever it is." And I would say that's true. I just never stop. I'm never happy with a beer, a process, whatever. It can always be better.
So good enough does not exist in your world?
No, good enough is not good enough, you know.
It's always something better.
Yeah, there it is.
But it seems there's a distinction where there's a very narrow distinction in that mindset to me, where there's the idea of where the grass is greener than my side of the fence, or, hey, we have it pretty good. I wonder how much better it could be next time.
I think I'm more of the it can be better next time. You know, and how do you define what good is? But there's always the grass is greener. There is not a better beer. There's a different beer. You know, you can always make a better beer. You can always make it better. Somehow you can make it better. It has a better shelf life. It has a better aroma. It has a better washout. Mm-hmm. It has whatever. But then there's always the dissidence of the world. There's that grass is greener beer.
Yeah.
You know, here's something new, and, you know, it's the hazy IPAs or the brute IPAs or, you know, the red chairs of the world.
Yeah.
You know, there's always those, wow, we can make a grass is greener type beer.
When I interviewed some friends of mine for this podcast, and Dan and Sarah Gamber, good friends of mine, who've traveled the world extensively and are now currently, as of this recording, still living in Spain for going on their second year now with their young kids. And when I asked him the question about what's your favorite place, and he gave me this drawn-out answer that didn't conclude other than basically what it came down to, his favorite place that he's been to, or of all the places, I should say, all the places he's been to, his favorite place is the next place. and I thought that philosophically behind that answer was, everything has been amazing, but I can't wait to see what's next. Like, you know, there's always a positive outlook at what's next, where we're going to go next, what we're going to experience. Good or bad is going to be a great experience. And it was such a neat, wonderful attitude that was all wrapped into that answer. And what you just said kind of made me think of the same type of attitude as far as, it's not bad. It's not the grass isn't greener on one side. It's there's always something out there that could be really, really cool. Let's go look for it.
So, great story. My family, my wife and my two children, they were, you know, 10 years old, that type of thing. And we're in Lucerne, Switzerland, and we hike up the hill, the mountain, through the gates with the cows with the bells on them, and the flowers, and it was just wonderful. It was a great hike, and we go over the ridge, and here's a cog railway.
Mm.
I knew it was there, but my children didn't. And my wife just, she enjoyed the walk through the pasture and whatever. And my kids got there and went like, Dad, why didn't you tell us about this? We could have taken the cog railway. We can take it on the way home. And when we get down to the bottom of the, we take the railway back home. And we get down to the bottom and I looked at my kids and I said, which one did you enjoy most? And they said, don't know, Dad, both. So same kind of deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So I suppose I should help get us back on track. Yeah, so here we were selling hops and developing better processes for hops. And meanwhile, we're kind of making a little bit of wine and growing some grapes. At some point, you ended up in Bend.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So I was doing many things at SS Steiner. And one of the things I was doing was they didn't see the craft industry coming. And I was pushing them in to the craft industry, selling some hops to them, and they were going with both feet dragging. I think I was pulling more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And so I was selling hops here and there, and one of my customers was Deschutes. And they called me up one day, and a guy named Paul Cook, who is worked for me, well, worked at Deschutes for a while, worked for me, and then went off to work at Ninkasi. And, well, actually, he started the Wildfire Brewery, and then he got forced out and then later went to Ninkasi. But anyway, he called me up and there was a jackhammer working in the background. It was like, hey, Larry, we have a brewery here and we're not too sure how to run it. I said, do you think you can run a fully automated Hoopman brew house? And I said, well, what size is it? Well, it's about 100 barrels. I go, yeah, I could probably run that. He says, well, you want to send a resume? And so I sent a resume. And that's how I ended up, working for Deschutes. And it was just a fantastic opportunity and fantastic ride. And
That's not how I imagined the story would go. Oh. I guess I kind of imagined that a limo was involved and you know, some white gloves somewhere along the line. I'm not sure, but it was just that quick little phone call.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So and I know Deschutes was never meant to be a long term thing for you, if I recall correctly.
Oh no, it could have been. It was,
I guess I heard or read somewhere that you had like a contract for a certain amount of time and then.
Oh, correct. Yeah.
Oh, so, okay.
So I had kind of watched brewers come and go from Deschutes and I made a pledge to my daughter. It was kind of like the last move daughter before college.
Gotcha.
And so it was a 5-year increment there. So when we moved from Yakima down, I promised her that she'd graduate from a Bend high school.
Gotcha.
And so that's how that all came about. And, you know, I've been very fortunate. I've been lucky. I've had fantastic jobs over my lifetime. They're paid well and really haven't needed to work. I mean, I needed to work for, that period of, getting my kids through college mm-hmm. type thing. And so I succeeded at that. And so that, i.e. the 5-year contract. And
gotcha.
I just didn't want to, go to Deschutes and be there a year or two and move on.
Gotcha. Yeah. But that was in the early 2000s though, right? That you ended up there. And so that's right about the time that I moved to Central Oregon. And I just remember, I was visiting, I'm very proud to say, I remember visiting Deschutes Brewery for the first time. I think it was 5 or 6 years old, and I was I was barely 21. It was this tiny little place in this snowy little town with a great mountain and some dark beer that had flavor, and I was thinking, all right, let's go out and check this place. And then we move up here, and it was that small pub was still there that I remembered, but not long after, then some construction started happening up the road a couple of years after that. This is about the time that you entered the Deschutes scene, correct?
Well, little later. I think that I think I've got my dates right. I think it was 93. I think that's right. 93 that Deschutes purchased the property on Colorado.
Okay.
And John Harris was the first brewmaster.
It's a great time to buy that property.
Yeah, great time. Fantastic time.
Great time.
So, yeah. So, you know, John Harris was there and a couple other guys. And then I came in on the scene. So I think I still hold the record for the longest brewmaster at Deschutes.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, apparently it's a great training ground, hence why you're called the Godfather. So
yeah. Oh no, Deschutes is a magical place. I love my time at Deschutes.
And so you had your direct hand, if not indirect influence, on some very tremendous beers. We've already talked about Red Chair, and that was a beer that came out and was it 2012 or somewhere around that went to the World Beer Cup and won best beer in the world for its style. Yeah. And of course, everyone back here in Central Oregon was thinking, oh, we have the best beer in the world. And, well, it's a little bit more complicated, but yeah, that was a really good beer. It still is. It's an amazing beer. And then right before we started recording, I shared this experience, but I'll elaborate again. But some years ago, the High Desert Museum down the road opened up this wonderful, a beer exhibit, the history of beer.
Oh, that's right.
And somehow, my wife and I scored tickets to go to that. And so naturally, we made the drive to go to that. And all the breweries were there sampling out their wares. And I was very much a beer neophyte, but at this time I had been brewing beer and becoming interested. I was a beer interested individual. And of course, you know, I know Deschutes, I've known it for quite some time. And I go up to the table and, what do you guys got? Well, we've got this, Dissident. Well, what is it? It's a Belgian style Flanders Oat Brewing. What the hell is that? I said, just try it. I took one sip, Larry, and I shared with you, I've had a few of these moments in my life where I call it the clouds parted and the angels sang. I immediately handed it to my wife. She thought it was horrid stuff because she's not a beer drinker, and that's not a beer for everyone. But I think I had, eight tokens for free samples. I think I wasted four or five of those just on Dissident alone. I kept going back.
I think that was a good investment.
It was a good investment. It was just, it's an amazing style of beer, amazing beer within that style. But that was another beer that you created. Another beer that some people may recognize, also called The Abyss.
Yeah.
It is just, that beer is now canonized in the great book of great beers. What other beers can you add to your list? That you brought into the world. I know Jubal's been there forever, but...
You know, there was one beer I made that I just really am disappointed. It was a beer called Buzzsaw Brown.
Oh, God, I love that beer.
Oh, I love that beer. It was a horrible name.
I've got a story when you're done with yours.
Okay, we did everything possible to kill that beer. But I don't know. I love that beer. It was a great beer. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, malty beers are not doomed, but they're a hard sell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, IPA, you can sell IPAs.
Keep the light on for everyone. Yep, yeah,
forever. So anyway, so that was a great beer. That was like one of my favorites. Chainbreaker, white IPA.
Yeah.
I really like that beer. But that was a very decisive beer. You know, there were people who didn't care for that. But there were people who just lost it over it, how wonderful it
but
was.
But a lot of those Belgian beers are very polarizing to begin with. So now you add some strong hops to it, and now you divide it even further. So
one of the crazy places where that beer was totally successful, Hawaii.
Really?
All places, yeah. It was a big seller there. So
wow, and we almost had a Deschutes in Hawaii then, I take it.
Yeah, almost.
Almost.
The Inversion, that was a real... I don't know, decisive moment at Deschutes. Deschutes made a beer called Quail Springs. Fantastic English IPA. East Kent Goldings, Golden Promise, other English malt that was in it, Maris Otter. Fantastic beer. Whenever I would get my case of beer, I would always make sure there was some Quail Springs there. But the problem was, it didn't sell. I mean, it was an old style. It wasn't we wouldn't call it a West Coast IPA. It was kind of almost what I would deem as a Northwest pale ale type thing. Anyway, so to get the Deschutes brewers to go in the kind of the West Coast IPA direction was monumental. And I don't think, you know, I mean, Inversion is a very solid beer, but I think it was a stepping stone to other great beers.
Yeah.
Kind of like the Fresh Squeezed, you know, that was getting developed as I was walking out the back door type thing.
Well, so. And as a writer, there's a saying where you have to kill your darlings. I mean, every little thing that comes across your desk or your computer or anything else, at some point you have to say, you know what, that was wonderful, but I have to let you go because we're moving on to the next thing.
Oh, exactly.
And it's hard, but it's critical. So the story I wanted to share with you on Buzzsaw Brown, that was one of my favorite beers back in that time, because I loved brown ales. And it was the Bond Street series, right? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
So I had a new young daughter that may be 1 year old, and I put her in the Deschutes onesie.
Yeah.
And then put her in her little swing. And because I had the day off and was watching my daughter, my wife was at work, I thought it'd be kind of funny to, I finished my bottle of Buzzsaw Brown, and I probably shouldn't say this on air, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I took the little bottle from, or the nipple from her bottle, and put it over the beer bottle, which was empty. There was nothing in it. In fact, I distinctly remember rinsing it out, just for the record. But I put the nipple on the Buzzsaw Brown bottle and stuck with my daughter and started taking pictures to send off to my wife. And so I've got this picture of my 1 year old daughter. She's now 10, but 1 year old daughter in the Deschutes onesie with a milk bottle nipple on the Buzzsaw Brown, just looked like she's drinking away. And it was a funny thing that in political circles, or politically correct circles, wouldn't go over well. But it was, I just have that image that of my daughter in the Buzzsaw Brown forever.
So here's a funny story, is that I've got a picture of my wife that my father-in-law took when she was in Fairbanks. She was probably a year and a half old, and they'd made a sled out of an Olympia beer case. And she was being pulled through the snow in Olympia beer case.
That's great.
Well, hey, another great beer that we haven't talked about that I just kind of appeared was the Hop Trip. You know,
when
fresh hop beers really weren't that popular. They really hadn't gained traction yet.
But that was a strong beer, if I recall.
Oh, not particularly.
It was like 6-7.
Yeah, it was a
So I remember drinking that beer and just loving it, and had a 22-ounce bottle, and by about 3/4 in, I was really starting to feel it and had to drive. And I remember that was the first time that I recall thinking I was just really annoyed at the alcohol content beers, because it was so good. I just want to keep on drinking it, but I had to stop.
And it was, sorry about that.
I accept your apology. Thank you. Well, given the time we have left, let's start talking about Crux. You did some great work at Deschutes. You trained a lot of great brewers who are doing some great things now, but at some point you left to finally, and the clouds part and the angels sing, to finally open your own brewery.
Yeah.
Crux Fermentation Project. And I remember the day it came out in the paper, and I was like, oh my gosh, what's this place going to be? And I've talked to people who were in the know, that the idea was that this was going to be a way to elevate the craft beer experience. How would you summarize it?
That's true.
What was the purpose of leaving Deschutes and opening Crux?
Have fun. It's simply to have fun. I mean, I'm a brewer. I love to brew beer. That's what I do. And, you know, really that's all I've ever done in my life is beer-related things in my job life. And, you know, I've always had to, in my entire life, sell people on the direction they should go, whether it's being, you know, hiring somebody at Olympia to brew craft beer in a forgotten cellar, or it's to make Abyss or Dissident or Hop Trip. I've always had to, almost like a political campaign, to get a product to market. At Crux, I don't have to do that. I'm thinking of a beer, and we're making it today, tomorrow, the next day, and we're reinventing. I mean, the kind of the battle cry of Crux has been the next great beer. And that's really what I want to do. You know, we just kind of keep pushing the boundary, playing with different ingredients, making next great beer. That's the objective.
So you sound like a home brewer with a large facility and a great view.
That's absolutely it. You know, it's that is the objective. The problem has been to run the business. And I think that you see a lot of brewers who fall into that trap of, hey, I've got to run a business. I started Crux with two other individuals, and I was 60, so I'm this is my retirement program.
Yeah.
And the branding fellow was 50, and the sales guy was 40. Well, they've since left, and so the responsibilities of running the company have fallen on my shoulders.
Yeah.
And Crux is now just getting to the point where I'm getting back at it. I'm finding my my place where I can spend more time on the brewing floor and such.
I was going to say you wanted to do this just to have fun again, but it seems like you've gotten mired in reams of paperwork and sitting behind a computer or teaching or whatever it is. Are you finally getting to do that which you loved?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I make, you know, trips to the brewery every day and, you know, try to shed some sunlight every place I go. And you know, even though, you know, you look around this cluttered office we're in, is that I'm making decisions that's for the best of the beer. Best for the beer, best for the people. You know, I could care if I make any money on this this venture. It's more about you know, staying independent, supporting the industry, and, you know, making great beers. I mean, it seems simplistic, but that's what I want to do.
That is a tremendous platform for the next question.
Good.
So this is the state of craft beer now. I think the last I saw, there's 6,000 breweries in the U.S. alone, which is just insane. Here in Bend and Portland and Oregon, there's just so many breweries and more coming every so often. A buddy of mine just sent me an article that there's like 150 breweries down in San Diego. And are we in a bubble?
I think we're in a tipping point. And what I mean by that is, the number one failure in America, business failure in America, is restaurants. And so the way I view it is that, you know, if you can supply beer to a restaurant, good beer to a restaurant, you're probably going to succeed. And what I see is the, you know, the 6,000, 7,000 breweries we have are getting more towards brew pubs than breweries. And so Crux is really more of a brewery than it is a brew pub. I mean, we have a fantastic brew pub, don't get me wrong. And
the food is tasty.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's very good.
And, you know, I'm trying to emulate experiences I've had with in Europe with families and dogs, and making it a very social place, not a drinking place. So I think America is shifting towards more of that. I think they're shifting towards, you know, it's not a tavern that the windows are all painted green, and, you know, it's that forbidden fruit. It's a place where, you know, families and friends and cohorts get together and have a beer and socialize and drink responsibly and eat and so on and so forth. And I think that's where it's really going. And so that's created a very awkward position for people who, or I should say people, brewers who are in, you know, 10, 15, 20 states, and their business is being encroached upon by a brew pub in every corner. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you're going to see people who have, you know, established a great business plan and are executing it are going to do real well. I think they're going to prosper. But I think people who just got into the brewing industry to make money are going to fail. Mm. So passion is going to win out is what I'm really trying to say.
God, I certainly hope so. Yeah. But it seems like there are several different plans that are out there. There's the go big and go multi-state and even international. And then there's the nano brewers that open up that corner brew house in that little small pub that serves a community. And both can coexist in that model. There's a spot. But where do you see craft beer going? I mean, they're all the breweries are getting bought out, not just from Anheuser-Busch. There's lots of mergers going on, even with Constellation and Ballast Point and Hop Valley. And where are we going as a craft beer community? What does the future look like in your crystal ball?
The craft brewing industry exists because people are open to paying for beers that are interesting, unique, and flavorful. And with the current climate of corporations buying breweries, craft breweries, I think they're going to fail. I think the public is going to route out, discover that these people are going to produce fairly bland beers for really, you know, low-cost pricing versus the corner pub, the nano, if you want to call it that, who is going to produce, you know, very interesting beers and be involved in what the customer has to say about it, be the face for the beer. The problem with it that I see is that, I'm a farm boy, so I've lived the life, and that is cows have to be milked every day, twice a day, and brewing beer is quite a bit like owning a dairy. You know, the yeast is always calling you. You have to take care of it. You have to, you know, and it's a lot of damn work is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a point where, you know, a size of a brewery relates to a sustainable business and can operate efficiently and make a profit. And I think that's where it's going to tip out. And I can't take that crystal ball and say this is where it's at, because I've seen small breweries that have existed for 100 years that have been really super small. Mm-hmm. And then obviously I've seen the huge breweries that have failed. So
I'm aware of these two. The first one that comes to my mind, small and been around forever, Yingling. And how they've survived with all this, especially distributing no further west than the Mississippi, to my knowledge, is just fantastic. But still, they're a very iconic brewery. But how is it? When I'm in my skeptical modes of thinking, then I just see that the big breweries taking over. And when I'm in my hopeful mode of thinking, then I see, you know, no, there's hope that people will actually care about the craft beer as much as you and I do. They'll see that there are bigger stories and there's more to it than just the beer in our hand. And hopefully hopefully that those are the sides that will win out the end of the day, because there's so much more to it.
So Dick Engling, I met him a zillion years ago. He was driving a forklift in a warehouse loading a truck. Passion. That keep the family company going. And
clearly leading from the front.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And now he's got three daughters. His daughters are taking over. They're running the company, and it's private. It's not a publicly held company. I would venture to guess that Olympia, if it hadn't gone, you know, post-prohibition, they went public, and it became a stock-held company. Mm-hmm. I would think they would still be in business today if they weren't a publicly traded company, or they had put in, anti-shark measures that were unheard of at the time.
Yeah. Well, and I the one and only chance I had to actually taste a Yuengling lager is when I was in the East Coast. I guess it was last year now, but God, that was a great beer.
Yeah,
that was a great beer. I'm sad we can't get it here very easily.
Yep.
Well, with the time we have, I've got two very big questions for you. One question is, if you were able to choose your last meal and your last beer, what would it be?
Oh, boy. It would be Alaska King Crab, and it would be in the pocket.
What does that mean?
In the pocket is a Brett-fermented golden ale.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's the name of the beer. Okay.
Yeah, in the pocket is a name that came from one of the employees here at Crux, and it's where the jazz player kind of gets everything together, and it's in the pocket type thing.
Okay. Oh, okay. I got it.
And I've spent a lot of time in Alaska fishing, and unfortunately, the times where we would take what was called a gurry barge out into the Alaskan ocean, and we would dump all the fish guts that came from the cannery. And we would stop by and pick up a crab net. We would rob the crab net. But in exchange, we would put a bottle of Jack Daniels or something else, Maker's Mark, in the crab net to say thank you, you know. And I think they were, you know, we would rebate the... Because we had the material to rebate with. But we would cook it on deck on this barge, and then have... light American lager with it, and that was great. But to have it with in the pocket was just totally amazing.
So tell me, what was in the pocket again? It was a Brett?
It was a Brett fermented, barrel-aged golden ale.
Oh.
Yeah, unbelievable. Yeah.
That sounds amazing, actually. Now that you describe it and flesh it out for me, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
So then the last question I have for you, Larry, is given everything that we've discussed even before and before we started recording, the question is, in your experience and everything that culminates in the sum of your experience, why does good beer matter?
So in 1972... I got off a plane in Frankfurt, Germany at probably 3 in the morning, took a train to Munich. I'm in the Bahnhof, and the guy next to me has a Weitwurst and a beer. And I ask him where he got it, and he... didn't speak any English or very little, and he basically said, come with me. Mm-hmm. And so we went over and a few Deutschmarks, and I got myself a Augustiner beer and a pretzel and a Weitwurst, and I sat there and ate it with him, and it was an epiphany. It was probably one of my better encounters beer-wise and food-wise. And we spoke or kind of tried to communicate for about a half hour before he had to catch his train. And the thing about beer is that it is a social lubricant that brings people together. And you have all these different beers out there, and you can argue which is the best beer you've ever had in your life, what is the so on and so forth. But it's more about your next beer and the next experience you're going to have with that person that you might meet just because of the beer. And when you go to Crux, you'll notice that we all have all communal tables, and they're all at a high level, just so that people can easily communicate. And that's why I think that beer matters.
That's excellent. In fact, I totally agree.
In fact, I would love to have a beer with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton sometime.
I would love to have my microphone rolling in that, just in case.
Yeah.
Just in case, you know, something happens.
You know, they might actually talk.
Well, give them a good beer.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, they might have an epiphany.
And then just for the sake of all this, how can people get a hold of, not necessarily you, but where can they find more about you and Crux and everything else?
www.cruxfermentation.com.
Great.
Yeah.
Any words of wisdom as we part off into the sunset?
Oh, I'm just looking for the next great beer.
That's great. Thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure.
Age-old wisdom tells us not to let our past define us, but instead, let it be our guide. Beer culture has always struggled with tradition versus innovation and big versus independent. If Sador's story tells us anything, it is that the future of beer will be decided by the beer each of us chooses. Join us in the next episode where we visit a woman who endured terrible disease, discovered her own cure, and started a prolific worldwide blog all through gluten-free beer. Good Beer Matters is a show about great beer, great friends, and the experiences we create together. But it's also about better appreciation of the beer you enjoy. I believe better education leads to better enjoyment. So if you're a beer and food professional or even a beer enthusiast, then please subscribe to Good Beer Matters. After that, grab a beer, hang out with friends, and let the world open up. Thank you for listening. Cheers.